Howdy, folks. Doug McBurney here. The Bob Enyart Live Telethon is on again. We need $30,000 to keep Bob Enyart broadcasting for another year, so I'm asking you to help us. Give us a call right now at 800-8-ENYART. That's 800-836-9278. Or go to the kgov.com website. Click on the store. Look at the subscriptions. Take a look at all the wonderful products. Sign up for a subscription to Bob's Bible Study, the sermons from Denver Bible Church, or the Best of Bob, and get a free Bob Enyart topical video as our gift to you. Donate $100 or more, get a free video. Donate $200 or sign up for two subscriptions and get two of Bob's topical videos free, our gift to you for helping Bob Enyart stay on the air for another year. We picked the shortest month of the year, February, so we're already running out of time. So pick up the phone now. Call 800-836-9278 or go to kgov.com to make a donation, purchase a product, or sign up for a subscription today.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. By the handiwork of God, tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. An evolutionist, after last week's program, wrote in to criticize me for interviewing David Coppedge. If you listen to that show, because even though we talked about astronomy and various general science topics, we did discuss evolution, and David worked for JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, on the Saturn Cassini mission, system lead for their ground systems for years, but he's not an evolutionist, he's not a biologist. And so this evolutionist, his name is Dennis, he said, Bob, you really should be talking to a biologist if you want to discuss evolution. And so I wrote back to Dennis. We wrote back and forth. And of course, my guest last week, he's a producer of science videos that have been watched by millions, and he has cross-disciplinary interests. So today, we want to get back to a topic we covered a couple years ago on the origin of Earth's radioactivity. But to get there, you got to get through all kinds of issues, like, for example, the initial creation of the Earth, geology, the global flood. But I thought, since the topic is radioactivity, wouldn't it be great to talk to the man who introduced Dr. Walt Brown to Dr. Adamenko from the Ukraine? Because that's where the whole origin of radioactivity really got off the ground. And so what an honor to welcome to Real Science Radio, Dr. Joshua Spencer. Dr. Spencer, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. It's nice to be on the show.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I think you do know something about nuclear science. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. I have a PhD and master's degree from the University of Illinois in nuclear engineering.
Wow, that's great. And I know that you've also minored in computational science, and you doubled in physics and math from Monmouth College. So I think I'm talking to a very qualified guest. And again, thank you for joining us. So is it true you're the one who introduced Walt Brown to this scientist in the Ukraine?
Well, I at least introduced him to his work. I happened to be in graduate school, and a member of Dr. Adamenko's team had given a seminar at University of Illinois to nuclear engineering graduate students. And I had started a conversation with Dr. Brown probably in the 2006-2007 time period, and he was very interested in talking to me because he was starting to get into this idea of the flood might be an idea of possible origin for Earth's radioactivity. So after that conversation started, it kind of kept my eyes open for research that would support that idea, and that's the idea of controlled nucleosynthesis, which is the name of Dr. Adamenko's work. Definitely provided a theoretical framework that some sort of electrical discharge could be a way where you can get excess neutrons, because in order to get radioactivity, you have to have some sort of neutron activation of material. If you start off with something that is not radioactivity, you can bombard that material with neutrons, and you can cause that material to become radioactive.
So let's get to that. a little later in the program, the Proton 21 lab work there in the Ukraine, mm-hmm. where they would bombard copper and unexpectedly create pretty much the entire periodic table out of copper, and how fascinating that is, and how that relates to the global flood and Dr. Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. But let's back up to the different flood models. You forwarded to me an email exchange you had with a leading creation geologist, and everyone would recognize his name, and he's a supporter of CPT, catastrophic plate tectonics. So you and he had a cordial exchange disagreeing. You're supporting the hydroplate theory explanation for the global flood, and he's mm-hmm. supporting something called catastrophic plate tectonics. So could we go there, Joshua? I'd like to work our way through your email exchange, and then we'll arrive back at the origin of radioactivity.
Sure.
So could we begin with your email dialogue with this creation geologist?
Yeah, we certainly can. The geologist in question had issues with basically thinking that the hydroplate theory starts off with a Pangaea model.
Oh, yeah, the supercontinent.
Which isn't correct.
Right.
And also claimed that the hydroplate theory doesn't give good explanations for how the Appalachian mountain chains, for example, formed.
The Appalachians on the eastern part of the United States, the north-south mountain range. Well, those are two really interesting issues. So he starts out saying that the hydroplate theory begins with the Pangaea supercontinent configuration. That's not exactly correct. And I've noticed this, Dr. Spencer, that when other creationists criticize the hydroplate theory, they often show that they don't understand the theory, they haven't read it carefully, and so even though it's not intentional, they misrepresent the theory. Walt does not support Pangaea. In fact, do you recall in his book where he shows a map of the globe the way they claim that Pangaea was an initial supercontinent and it broke up? He really tears that whole claim to pieces.
Yeah, it's the classic geology textbook. I mean, you get all the way down to like grade school where they kind of show that, you know, look, all the continents kind of fit together like puzzle pieces. But the problem is, in order to actually get them to fit like puzzle pieces, you have to like rotate some of the continents. That you sort of have to shrink other continents by a substantial amount to kind of get them to fit. And they don't really talk about the fact that, oh, by the way, there's a whole ocean worth of material under, or there's a bunch of material under the continents that they don't explain where that stuff came from.
In fact, Africa,
a lot of problems.
In the typical diagram we'd see of the continents together, they shrink Africa by 35% to make it fit with North America and South America. So that's sort of like cheating, because then even off the coast is the continental shelves. So they're larger than they look from the surface. So you can't really shrink Africa, and the way they're all rotated in three different ways, it shows that that whole Pangaea argument is superficial and not true. But clearly the hydroplate theory does not begin with that starting condition. In fact, Walt presents a global continent that has many shallow seas, and not one supercontinent like that.
That's correct.
Josh, when this geologist says that Walt Brown begins with Pangaea, I went back in our studio. We have the 6th edition of his text, the 7th edition, the 8th edition. So that goes back over 20 years in his print editions. And I searched his website, all of that, and do not find the word Pangaea in any of the indexes. They all have very good indexes, and it's not on his website. So I think that's just another indication that that's not a valid representation of the starting conditions of Walt's model.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I know that the earlier video, so there's a few different videos that have had Walt being interviewed over the years.
Yes.
And certainly the earlier one, he refers to the initial conditions of the Earth being probably a very large supercontinent. And I think a lot of people certainly could take that
yes.
and say, okay, well, what very large supercontinent did I maybe read about when I was in sort of middle school?
Yeah, so that's a very
and that
good
would
point.
Be yeah. a place where people could get confused. And if you don't sort of finish reading or listening to the rest of what he says, he's talking about mostly land, which you would need in order to actually have enough vegetation for all the coal seams and everything else that would have actually have the biomass to have the coal and oil that we do have.
Wow. So that the Earth was originally largely covered by land with
that's correct.
Embedded many shallow seas. So, okay, and thank you for that clarification. It's a great point. Okay, so that's a first objection that I think is not valid. How about the point about the Appalachians, the formation of that mountain range?
Yeah, so a geologist in question, it basically said that because you have a fossil-bearing strata, if you will, in the Appalachian mountain range, that that was probably something that kind of happened before the flood, perhaps. Mm. And that wouldn't necessarily fit with Walt's model.
With the hydroplate theory.
With a hydroplate model. But that's not quite right, because if Walt's model is correct, I mean, you're going to start laying down sedimentary layers almost immediately after the rupture phase. You're going to get a lot of earth moving around with the liquefaction process that's going to start the fossilization process almost immediately.
You just mentioned, Dr. Spencer, the rupture phase of the flood. And
yes.
Walt's model has four phases, the rupture phase, and that's when the fountains of the Great Deep broke forth, and the mid-oceanic ridge, that's a scar in the crust of the earth that wraps around the earth like the seam of a baseball. The reason the crust of the earth is cracked is because of the global flood. On one day, all the fountains of the Great Deep broke forth. And so that's the first phase, the rupture phase. Then there's the flood phase, as for months that water is coming up from under the crust of the earth. And then Walt has something called the continental drift phase, which formed the mountains. And then the final phase is the recovery phase, which essentially we're still in today. But so you just said that after the rupture phase, fossils would begin forming, sedimentary strata would begin being created immediately. And that would last until the continental drift phase. So the fact that across North America, there are strata with fossils, and those mountains in the western, in the Rocky Mountain region where we are, on the East Coast, the Appalachians, they were pushed up within hours, not over millions of years. And so the strata and the fossil-bearing strata that's part of all that process, that's directly related to the claims of the hydroplate theory. It's not as though the theory doesn't address those.
Yeah, that's correct.
That, I'd say, is a second objection that seems to be a result of not understanding the model.
So I replied to the geologist that I support the hydroplate theory for the following reason, is that if you take from a 30,000-foot level, the hydroplate theory really only has one major assumption, and that assumption is that there was, in the beginning, a large body of water underneath the crust of the earth.
Wow.
And
so you support it because it's a simple model, because it starts with one primary assumption.
That's correct. And the reason why that's important is the whole field of geology, and like I said, I'm not a geologist, I'm an engineer by training. But when you talk about geology, you're largely talking about something, I mean, there's things you can observe today, but when you're dealing with an origins type topic, you're dealing with what's referred to as historical science or forensics, where your toolkit as a scientist in that field is slightly different than operational science, where you can use the kind of the classic scientific method, where you sort of have a control and you can basically make a prediction or have a hypothesis that you can test in a laboratory.
Right.
So when you develop a theory of origins, you have a different toolkit. So you've got to basically build up a theory that's based on things that you can describe in a laboratory. You also want to have theories that are based on things you can observe and a couple of simple assumptions, because obviously you don't have all the initial conditions. You don't know everything, so you have to fill in gaps in your knowledge with assumptions. But based on those simple assumptions and things in physics you can describe and observe in the laboratory, you should be able to predict the situation on Earth, in this case, as we have, right? So there's a couple of fancy scientific words for some of those things, like the concept of Occam's razor was popularized quite well in a movie a few years back, Contact, where they talk about Occam's razor, which is all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one. So the idea is if you have to have a lot of assumptions, like if this happens and this happens and this happens, then, you know, that's a lot less of a strong theory than you can say, well, in the beginning, God created the earth and that earth happened to have a lot of water under the crust.
Right.
And based on that one assumption, and if you let the physics, such as, you know, the tidal pumping of the moon is going to cause stretching in the earth crust, which is going to cause additional pressure. And because that additional pressure that builds up to some point where you have a rupture of that crust, and that causes the rupture phase we had talked about.
And so then we have the fountains of the great deep bursting forth and the water shooting up into the atmosphere and coming down as torrential rain. And so you say that to this geologist, you support the hydroplate theory because from a very high level, it has one basic assumption that the water for the flood existed below the crust before the flood.
Right.
And what's interesting about that one assumption is that many observations have found water and even salt water deep below the surface of the earth where it was not expected. So that sort of affirms the idea that there was this water below the crust. And then also the Bible itself says that God rocketh the earth, that he rocketh the earth above the waters. It says that on day two, he made the rakia when he rocketh the earth, and he divided the waters above the rakia from the waters below. And I think that that tells us, you know, if we look at the etymology of our English word rock, it goes back to the medieval Latin rocca. And I think that goes right back to the city of Raqqa in Syria. You know, ISIS, that's their headquarters, Raqqa. And in fact, even the nation of Iraq, which comes from Uruk, which is deeply rooted, well-watered, because the waters came from under the Raqqa, under the rock. And so you have the Bible telling us that God made the waters for the flood under the Raqqa. And you have this geologist who are figuring out that there's a tremendous amount of water and even salt water deep below the surface of the earth, way further than they expected. Every one of these discoveries is shocking, is surprising. So that all seems to say that the assumption isn't even a total assumption. It's like God tells us that's how he did it.
That's right. It's interesting that when Genesis, where it talks about, you know, the beginning of the flood, it says, you know, talks about the bursting forth of the great deep in a single day, right? And then it says that's the first cause, and it talks about opening of the windows of heaven, right? So you have the first cause is the fountains of the great deep, and then then it's going to rain later. And a lot of people start with, it rained a lot. Well, that's sort of an effect, not necessarily a cause.
It rained for 40 days, but the waters continued to prevail, to rise on the earth for 150 days.
Yes.
So why did they continue? It's because the water was coming up from below the crust.
That's right.
And that's the only way you get the waters to continue to rise for months after the rain stopped, because the source of the water is below the crust. So this creationist, I love this guy, the guy that you were interacting with. I've followed his work for decades. He loves the Lord. He's led many to trust in Jesus Christ by his effort to teach the world that God created us. And, you know, there was no Big Bang. There was no Darwinism. We didn't evolve from worms or ape-like creatures. And so I really appreciate this guy, but there is this disagreement, this high-stakes disagreement.
Right.
So, Josh, how did the geologist respond then?
Well, when I raised this point, the geologist said he completely agreed that the Bible clearly states the flood began with fountains of the great deep bursting open and a torrent of rain falling from the heavens. But he claimed that the catastrophic plate tectonics model accounts for that. He says that there was a lot of water entrained in the mantle.
Yeah.
That was what burst forth.
So that the upper mantle, just below the crust, there was water in the upper mantle, and it was released by volcanic eruptions. Have you gone to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, Answers in Genesis? Have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there 3 times.
Oh, so have I. 3 times. Led groups of people there. Love Ken Ham, love AIG, and the Creation Museum. But there's a peculiar animation in the museum. It's to promote the catastrophic plate tectonics, CPT, view of the global flood. And it shows magma coming up from below the crust. And you see it hitting the surface of the Earth. And it shoots up into the atmosphere as supersonic jets of water. It just strikes me that the physics do not support that. Because magma, even if it came up under, let's say, a sea, and it hit seawater, that happens all the time today. Like in Hawaii, we've gone to Hawaii repeatedly. Magma's constantly coming from under the ocean and flowing into the ocean, and it doesn't create supersonic jets. In fact, it instantly hardens the magma that hits the water. It hardens, and so, but it doesn't create jets like that. So if the magma came up on land, it wouldn't create supersonic jets of water. And if it came up under the seas, it wouldn't do that. So that doesn't seem to be experimentally defensible.
And again, it goes back to what we were talking about before. I mean, you should be able, a good theory should be based on things you do observe, right? And so if when you see lava splash out on water, yeah, you're going to get some steam, but it's not typically like a jet-focused bunch of steam like the hydroplate theory describes.
Mm. With the hydroplate theory, of course, when the crust cracked open, and from 50, 60 miles beneath the surface of the Earth, the water is coming up with enormous pressure and force, and the energy budget available to do all that is enormous because of the insights from your field of nuclear science, then that explains exactly how the water ends up getting into the upper atmosphere and how comes down all over the globe in a torrential way. Well, this geologist, he brought up something about creation geologists not supporting Walt Brown's model. Could you share that part of the email with us?
Yeah, something of an ad hominem attack, or just basically attack on Will, says, well, I mean, why are you challenging me? You're not a geologist. And he said, doesn't it not strike you that there are no young Earth qualified geologists that are supporting the hydroplate model?
Josh, let me tell you, I've heard that for over a decade, that there are no creation geologists who support Walt's model. And so I think we should talk through that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So that, again, demonstrates that probably they haven't read Walt's book, because it's interesting. If you look on the very first printed page in Walt's book, there's at least one geology professor listed among the people that basically giving a lot of very positive accolades about Walt's book
theory
in general.
Dr. Douglas Block, who's in Rockford, Illinois, at a college there. But let me say this, and this is sort of cheating, because I'm not going to give his name, but there are so many creation scientists working for major institutions that simply cannot come out of the closet. They just can't, because they'd be gone. They'd ruin their career. But there is a professor of geophysics who is working at a leading university, probably one of the top 10 universities in the world for geophysics. And he has rejected plate tectonics. He supports the hydroplate theory. He has become a friend of Walt Brown. And so far, he's had the courage in one class to tell his class to give the argument against plate tectonics and then the argument for the hydroplate theory. Now, that's dramatic. That's almost like him coming out of the closet. But so far, the ACLU doesn't know about it. The Freedom From Religion guys, the Eugenie Scott's group, you know, because they would all sue and they do everything they could to get him off that faculty, to get him fired. That's anonymous. So I guess that doesn't count. But there are a lot of scientists and engineers who are openly supporting Walt's work.
Yeah, that's right. One of the benefits of not being formally trained in geology is that we don't have a lot of the preconceptions that come with, you know, being educated in any field, right? So when you're educated in a field, a lot of times you're taught basically not only just how to think, but kind of what to think and what is the kind of the standard model in a particular field. But when you kind of come to a topic like geology from, you know, from an engineering background, I mean, you've got to do obviously a lot of reading, and people like that tend to kind of try to, you know, evaluate things more from a first principle standpoint. And a lot of times that can be a real advantage because you don't sort of already assume you know who the winner is if you're looking at this from a competitive standpoint.
And for example, for all the scientists who have degrees in biology who come around to say, you know, I believe there's a God, those guys, they're not young earth Christians, the majority of them, but they believe that God created us. And so they tend to be theistic evolutionists because they have the baggage that they picked up with their degree.
Yep.
And so they've got their Darwinism and they incorporate their Darwinism into the Bible. So if you're a geologist, then you pick up through your secular degree, plate tectonics, but you believe God created us. And because you believe in the global flood, you're a young earth creationist. So then you incorporate plate tectonics, your baggage, into your flood model. And so you got catastrophic plate tectonics. And I think you're right that easily is as much a hindrance as it might be a benefit.
Yep. Yeah, the benefit definitely is you have probably a lot of field experience where you've actually looked at rocks and you learn how to catalog them and stuff like that. But yeah, the downside is that you kind of have been taught a lot of theories on, you know, how that rock got there, right? And that's something we didn't observe. And that's, again, where you have to kind of look with a specific set of glasses. And if you've been trained for, you know, going all the way through a PhD in geology, then your set of glasses are going to be kind of trained in and focused along that path.
And since the global flood was undoubtedly an interdisciplinary event, right? It wasn't only geology. It involved many different disciplines of science. It's sort of neat that there are so many different scientists and engineers who do openly support Walt's theory. For example, I've just begun, I want to create my own list, and I'd like to put it online. But if it's okay with you, Dr. Spencer, I'd like to include Dr. Joshua Spencer, PhD in nuclear engineering, on the list. But then there's Dr. Stuart Patterson, a former academic dean and professor of chemistry at Furman University. There's Dr. Kent Davey, senior research scientist, the Center for Electromechanics at the University of Texas at Austin. There's Dr. Stanley Mumma, professor of architectural engineering at Penn State University. There's a friend of mine, Jane Albright. She's a professional engineer formerly with the U.S. Navy nuclear program in your field. Also, here's another one that has to be anonymous for now, but I have a photograph here of a NASA astronaut who piloted the shuttle on one of its, you know, last missions to the International Space Station. And I asked him if I could post this photo online. He said, please wait until I, you know, leave NASA. But he's in the International Space Station in front of a portal. You can see the Earth in the background. And floating in front of him is Dr. Walt Brown's In the Beginning and the Hydroplate Theory. He brought it into space so he could continue to study. You know, these guys are scientists of the first order. So Walt has a tremendous amount of support from many engineers and scientists in many different disciplines. Your geologist friend asked you why there are no creation geologists who support the hydroplate theory. And so you mentioned Dr. Doug Block. I mentioned the professor of geophysics at a leading university. I have another response to that. It's not as though there are thousands of creation geologists who've weighed in on the matter. I want to make a list of those too. I think off the top of my head, I could think of about a half a dozen who have supported the CPT, and I could think of a couple who opposed the CPT, like Phil Budd and Michael Ord. They're two creation geologists who oppose catastrophic plate tectonics. I've got a friend who works at the USGS. I see him on Friday nights when we go to the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. He doesn't support catastrophic plate tectonics. So the handful that do, Andrew Snelling, John Baumgartner, Timothy Cleary, Steve Austin, Kurt Wise, I think they're offset by other creation geologists who reject CPT. And that whole issue, it's like science is not decided by majority vote.
That's absolutely right.
So that seems to be a distraction from the merits of the arguments of both sides. Dr. Spencer, we've run out of time for this episode, but if it's all right with you, I'd love us to continue on the next episode of Real Science Radio. Will that work for you?
That'll work just fine.
Oh, that's just great. Thank you very much. And what I want to ask about is this other creation geologist who said that miracles have nothing to do with catastrophic plate tectonics. I was shocked to read that because of how we've documented it's based on miracles. And then we'll get into Dr. Adamenko and Walt Brown's theory of the origin of radioactivity with Dr. Joshua Spencer. I can't wait for that. In the meantime, we have our telethon to help Bob and Yurt Live and Real Science Radio stay on the air for another year. Please help out if you can. Go to our website, rsr.org, click on the store, browse the science department, and if you can, perhaps make a donation, one time or a monthly donation. If you subscribe to any of our studies or videos, we multiply the subscription amount, whether it's $20 a month, $35, $50 a month. We multiply that by 10 to apply it to our telethon goal of $30,000. And of course, a donation will be so appreciated and is so needed. So thank you so much for your support. And this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.